This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Welcome to Lingua Franca on ABC Radio National. I'm Jill Kitson. This week, the lost languages of captured wives in the Amazon. David Fleck on the language of the Matses of Western Amazonia. When the Latin-speaking Roman legions withdrew from Britain in 410 AD, they left few linguistic traces in the language of the Anglo-Saxons. By contrast, the Norman conquest of Britain in 1066 led, over time, to a huge influx of French loanwords into the English language. Today, the Académie Française, the official authority on the French language, tries to resist lexical borrowings from English into French by inventing Gallic equivalents. Why the interaction of societies, through conquest, migration, alliances or trade, should produce such different effects upon languages is an important topic of study for linguists. For most of human history, of course, intersocietal interactions were intertribal. At this small-scale level, are lexical intruders welcomed or repelled? Peruvian-born David Fleck is an American postdoctoral fellow at La Trobe University's Research Center for Linguistic Typology. For the last 10 years, he's been working with the Matses, a tribe of hunters and farmers in the Amazon Basin, who were unknown to the outside world until 1969. Their language, Matses, is one of the Panoan family of languages. Until two generations ago, many Matses wives were women from other non-Matses-speaking villages who'd been captured by Matses raiding parties. Did their various languages enrich Matses? Here's David Fleck.
First of all, let me introduce you to the Matses, whose language is my principal research language. The Matses live in western Amazonia on both sides of the Peru-Brazil border. There are about 2,400 Matses living in 17 small villages, which are essentially just clusters of thatched houses surrounded by rainforest and slash-and-burn horticultural plots. Almost all the Matses speak Matses as their first language, and 70 to 80% are still essentially monolingual. They established peaceful relations with the outside world only 37 years ago in 1969. Which is relatively recent compared to most Amazonian groups, though there are still a few groups in the area I work in that remain uncontacted today. The Matses procure almost all their food through traditional subsistence strategies, including hunting, fishing, and slash-and-burn farming. But every year, they come into closer contact with the outside world and are abandoning most other aspects of their traditional culture. Nevertheless, because their first contact was so recent, their language shows little influence from Spanish and Portuguese, and the older Matses still possess undiminished traditional knowledge and pride in their traditional values and beliefs. Sadly, the same cannot be said for the younger generation. The listeners may be curious about how I came into contact with the Matses. It happened 15 years ago when I was a zoology undergraduate student conducting research in Amazonian Peru on rainforest marsupials, so it's oddly appropriate that this research would eventually lead me to my present position in Australia. The research locality where I was doing my opossum trapping studies was near a non-tribal town. The Matses would occasionally go to that town to sell smoked meat and purchase tools, shotgun shells, clothing, and other things. I met some of them there one day, and they invited me to visit their village, which was a four-day walk away through virgin rainforest. At the Matses village, the chief learned that I was studying animals and invited me to do my research in his village. He and the other Matses offered to help me capture animals and teach me natural history. I accepted their offer, and for my master's thesis research project, I spent a total 2 years living with the Matses studying the local mammal diversity, Matses folk classification of animals, plants, and rainforest types, and Matses knowledge of natural history. I liked the people and their way of life so well that I decided that I must change my profession so that I could work with Indians for a living. During my zoology research, I had found learning the Matses language a rewarding process, and so I switched to linguistics and spent another 2 years collecting data to write a descriptive grammar of the Matses language for my PhD dissertation. While living among the Matses, I learned that a number of the old women were not Matses, but had been captured as girls or young women during raids as recently as 40 years ago. There are about 20 of them still living among the Matses. Some of these women had been taken from Spanish or Portuguese-speaking villages, and others from tribes that still exist today, like Marubo and Kapanawa. But of greatest interest were others who spoke languages that had never been documented before. I recognize three of these undocumented languages as being in the Panoan family, the same linguistic family to which Matses belongs. The Matses told me that they exterminated some of these tribes, except for the women that they captured. So unless some of their relatives escaped and are still living in hiding, these captured women are the last living speakers of their language. This situation is a linguistic goldmine in several ways. First, it provides the opportunity to document three previously unknown Panoan languages, even though they have forgotten much and mixed their language with Matses, so it will never be possible to do an in-depth description as I did with Matses. Second, it provides a chance to study a type of linguistic contact that may have been very common in Amazonian elsewhere in ancient times, but is essentially unheard of today. Currently, for my postdoctoral research project, I am studying these Panoan languages. What I am investigating is whether the captives' languages have influenced the language of their captors, namely the Matses language. I am pursuing two lines of inquiry, a linguistic one and an ethnographic one. The linguistic investigation involves examining the linguistic patterns of all the languages involved to try to detect evidence of lexical or grammatical borrowing. The ethnographic exploration involves interviewing captive women, the men who captured them, and others in Matses society to learn the details of how the women were captured, how they were incorporated into the society, and the role of their mother tongues in their post-capture lives. The ethnographic part seems to be the more interesting, and is what strangers I sit next to on the airplane prefer to hear about. So I will talk about that first. The Matses form raiding parties composed of 8 to 12 men, usually residents of several different communal longhouses. They would have a ceremony where they would perform war chants and war dances before setting off. Then they would travel through the rainforest for several months, covering hundreds of kilometers, in search of the villages of other Indians or non-Indian villages. They had several strategies, including shooting the other Indians' longhouse with flaming arrows, waiting for a group of people to isolate themselves from the main group, or tricking other Indians into thinking that they wanted to join up with them. Then they would kill the men, grab the girls and women, and hurriedly take them all the way back to the Matses village. The following year, a second Matses raiding party would be formed of a different set of men, except for one or two from the previous expedition who would serve as guides. Sometimes the other groups would fight back or even perform retaliation raids on the Matses, but overall the Matses sustained few losses. A captured woman or girl would immediately become the wife of a Matses man, usually of her captor. But sometimes, if a man already had too many wives, the Matses are polygamous, he might give a captured woman to his brother, son, or other relative. If a girl was too young, her husband would refrain from having sex with her until she reached puberty. These episodes, as one can easily imagine, were terribly traumatic events for the women involved. When working with them, I am always impressed by the strength and courage that it must have taken for them to pick up the pieces and go on to have normal and even happy lives. Working in favor of these captured women and girls is that once they were married, they would have the same social status as any Matses woman, and they would be adopted so that everyone in the village would become their relative. A captive woman's adopted brothers would be honor-bound to intervene if her husband was abusive. And overall, these women were treated kindly. Likewise, with the children of the captive women, they are considered full-blooded Matses. This cruelty followed by kindness can be understood in part in light of the Matses classification of humans and animals. The Matses word Matses means person or human, and the Matses consider only themselves to be true humans. In Matses society, it is unacceptable to kill or abuse a fellow human, but it is okay to do so with animals and people who are not classified as human. When a woman is captured, she is given full human status. However, this assimilation process also involves abandoning her mother tongue and learning the only true human language, Matses. Furthermore, because the Matses took only a handful of captives during each raid, and they often ended up in different longhouses, bilingual speech communities were never established. As a result of this, children did not learn to speak fluently their captive mother's language. Husbands, sons, daughters, and others in the household typically learned a few dozen words in their captive relative's language, but only as a curiosity. So the captives' languages fell out of use, at least until a linguist came around to ask about them. One of the more interesting cases is that of a woman named Kira, the mother of the elected village chief of one of the villages where I work. Kira was captured twice. First, she was captured as a girl when a now-extinct tribe called Chema raided her village. Then, when Kira was a young woman, the Matses raided the Chema and captured her along with some Chema women. Kira's co-wife is a woman who was captured from a third tribe. Now Kira teaches me two languages, though unfortunately she has forgotten much due to the fact that she stopped speaking these languages when she was captured. With the absence of widespread bilingualism in the Matses community, there was little opportunity for grammatical borrowing. But I had a hypothesis that large-scale lexical borrowing had occurred from captives' languages that were sister languages to the Matses. Specifically, I refer to terminology for game animals. The Matses have up to 5 synonymous terms for most species of game animals, all of which hunters are expected to know. When old men visit another longhouse, they quiz the young men on these terms, giving the young men a chance to show off their hunting knowledge. Since I was frequently quizzed on these game synonyms, I made sure that I memorized them correctly to avoid looking like a fool. For example, a Matses man might ask me, "Tetsiket poshtonku murai," which means, "How many names does the woolly monkey have?" And I would respond with a list, "Poshto, abukid, chuna, murante chued, matsinkid," and then I would feel real proud if I got it right. When I began to study the Panoan captives' languages, I was surprised to find that many of their terms for game animals were the same as those in the Matses game synonym sets. In light of this, I formed the hypothesis that the captive women's languages were serving as sources for the elaborate Matses game terminology. After more detailed study, however, I found that all the evidence led to the conclusion that the game synonym sets did not include borrowed terms, thereby disproving my hypothesis. There are 2 main lines of evidence for this conclusion. The first is that the synonym sets can be shown to have existed in the mother language. The second is that the Matses resist the borrowing of foreign terms. It seems that, like the French, the Matses object to lexical borrowing from languages spoken by cultures that they consider below them.
Dr. David Flick of La Trobe University's Research Centre for Linguistic Typology. And that's all for this week's Lingua Franca.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.